It is Monday, October 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, tensions rise between Turkey and the United States.
The big concern is, where does everything go from now?
Pressure mounts on the leadership of Spain's Catalonia region to declare independence. And on Columbus Day, we look at the controversy surrounding Christopher Columbus. It's all ahead. Turkey on Monday urged the United States to reverse its temporary halt to non-immigrant visa applications, a move that was quickly mirrored by Turkey the day before. The Turkish Foreign Ministry summoned the U.S. Embassy's deputy chief Monday to urge Washington to reverse its decision, saying it's causing unnecessary tension and has harmed Turkish financial markets. Last week, Turkey arrested Metin Topuz, a U.S. consulate employee and Turkish national, accusing him of communication with leading members of what Turkey has deemed a terrorist network it blames for a failed coup last year. Turkey blames the attempted coup on U.S.-based Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen, who denies involvement. I spoke with reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul about yet another arrest warrant for another worker at the U.S. consulate.
The Istanbul Prosecutor's Office has announced that they want to interview another employee, a local employee working at the Istanbul consulate. That would be the second person that would be detained in connection with last year's failed coup. The Prosecutor's Office has also confirmed that they have detained this person, the suspect's wife and son. And we understand that, according to some media reports, that the person wanted is taking refuge in the Istanbul consulate, although that hasn't been confirmed. But there's indication, despite the severe pushback by Washington over the detention of one of its employees last week, the Ankara and the judicial and prosecution service are continuing with their investigations.
Well, now, in regard to the sort of the visa shutdown or the stoppage of that, I mean, that is affecting Turkey's financial status as well.
It certainly is. This came as a big shock to the financial markets. The Turkish lira fell heavily, as did the stock market. And that is an indication of how deep the concern is with this rising tensions with the United States. Up until now, there was this hope that they could be confined to behind the scenes. There have been simmering tensions for more than a year since the failed coup attempt. But now that it is out in the open, with both sides taking sanctions against the other, has caused alarm in the financial markets. And there is a deep concern going forward what the financial as well as the political and diplomatic implications of these rising tensions will be.
And what has generated this latest standoff between the two countries? You know, of course, there was the failed coup. But this, it seems like it has just simmered tremendously just in the last week.
Well, indeed, this has been a long time coming. I mean, ever since the failed coup attempt, and there was a lot of anger in Ankara that they felt that Washington didn't come to Turkey's aid quickly enough. And there was even suspicions voiced by some ministers in the government claiming there was some involvement in the U.S. by the U.S. in that failed coup, although that was strongly denied by Washington. But those suspicions have been going on for some time. Within the pro-government media, you regularly hear reports accusing Washington of being involved in the coup attempt. And the fact that remains that, according to Ankara, the architect of that coup, Fethullah Gulen, lives in the United States. He's a Turkish Islamic cleric. Ankara is demanding his extradition. Washington insists that is a matter for the courts. But that has been a major point of tension between Ankara and Washington. And feeding into that, beyond that, there's also anger that Washington is supporting a Syrian Kurdish militia in its fight against the Islamic State. Ankara accuses that militia of being linked to the PKK, which is a terrorist organization, according to the United States and the European Union. And this is also feeding into this wider feeling of distrust. They are NATO allies, but for well over a year, there has been this growing distrust between the two allies. Up until now, that has been confined to behind the scenes, but now it is in the public domain. And the big concern is, where does everything go from now?
Dorian Jones reporting from Istanbul, Turkey. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, we're used to seeing President Trump engaging in a war of words on Twitter. It's something he's done time and time again with a number of different people. But we're seeing an unusual war of words this time because he is fighting with a member of his own party. Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee announced that he is retiring from the Senate. He will not run for re-election in 2018. And he has sounded off against President Trump and the Trump White House, saying that it is like an adult daycare center, that the White House every day has to manage Trump and try to keep him from causing a crisis. Well, President Trump responding to this on Twitter, saying that Corker is a negative voice, that he begged Trump to endorse him, and Trump said no. It's a very interesting back and forth, like I said, because these are two members of the Republican Party. Corker is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, seen as a very kind of steady voice in as far as in Congress. So it's quite an unusual fight, and one that has a lot of people concerned, especially going up into the congressional elections in 2018. A lot of people now fearful that this is a signal that President Trump is going to sound off against other Republicans and potentially put the party in jeopardy of losing the U.S. House of Representatives or the Senate. But this is unusual, to say the least, as we pretty much said for everything that President Trump has done. He has broken ground in one way or another, particularly on social media, and this is one of those instances today.
Yeah, he certainly uses Twitter enough. Yeah.
Yes, he does. And lots of people using Twitter today to talk about Columbus Day. You're going to be talking about that, I know, a little later on in the show. There's a debate on social media that you'll get into about whether it's Columbus Day, honoring Christopher Columbus, or it's Indigenous Peoples Day, celebrating cultures that face colonization or imperialism. Lots of organizations and groups are using today to try to highlight their plight, particularly Native Americans, trying to use Columbus Day as a way to show that they're very marginalized in U.S. society, and they're a number of campaigns on social media where they're doing that. But the one thing I'll close with is this line that I've seen trending. The only Christopher we acknowledge is Wallace. It's a song by the rapper Jay-Z that refers to Christopher Wallace, otherwise known as the rapper Notorious B.I.G. So that's one way that people are striking back against Columbus Day, saying the only Christopher we recognize is our favorite rapper, not this man, Christopher Columbus, who has some controversy surrounding him.
All right. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Deadly attacks prompt the International Committee of the Red Cross to drastically cut its operations in Afghanistan. The White House will withdraw from the previous administration's plan to slow global warming. President Trump says U.S. policy on North Korea has failed for 25 years. And a Hollywood mogul is fired in the aftermath of sexual harassment disclosures. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A couple of years ago, the internet buzzed with news that a massive structure built by an advanced civilization of extraterrestrials might be orbiting a star located about 1,280 light-years from Earth. The erratic dimming and brightening of a star known as Tabby's Star has stumped astronomers around the world. A new study using data from NASA's Spitzer and Swift missions as well as the Astrolab IRIS Observatory in Belgium rules out that an ET-built megastructure is the cause of the star's odd dimming patterns. Instead, the study suggests the cause is an uneven dust cloud moving around the star. Researchers say they found less of the dimming effect while observing in infrared light than in ultraviolet light. They add that any object larger than dust particles would show equal dimming in all wavelengths of light. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, spring temperature records tumble in Australia. Pressure is mounting on plans by the leadership of Spain's Catalonia region to declare independence, perhaps this week, after hundreds of thousands rallied in the regional capital Barcelona for a united Spain.
El pueblo de Cataluña se dé cuenta de que no todos son
This protester said not all Catalans are separatists. Many more feel they're Spanish and want to belong to Spain. An estimated 350,000 turned out for Sunday's demonstration, a week after Catalonia held an illegal independence referendum. More than 40% cast ballots October 1st, with 90% voting yes to independence. Stuart King is a senior lecturer in Spanish and Catalan history. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty those in Catalonia opposed to independence use the protest as their chance to express their wish to remain tied to Spain.
Because the referendum was declared illegal, many of them didn't turn out to vote. And this is their opportunity now that there is actually the possibility, or the Catalan government is talking about declaring independence. This is their chance now to articulate their desire to remain within Spain.
Well, Stuart, Carles Puigdemont, the president of Catalonia, is expected to address the parliament 6 p.m. local time on Tuesday. What might he say?
That is an interesting question. I think he will declare that Catalonia is independent. I personally don't think that he is particularly in favor of independence. I think he has been sort of pushed into this by sort of political forces, much of which is his own making. But I think, yes, we will get a declaration of independence the next time the Catalan Parliament meets.
Would that provoke the Madrid central government to invoke this article, I believe it's 155, that would disband the regional government and call for new elections?
I think that is a very strong possibility. In my reading of this situation, you've got the Spanish central government is being just as intransigent as the Catalan government on this matter. And I feel that they're rather than stopping and saying, well, let's have a proper dialogue about this, they're just reinforcing their positions. And I think the natural outcome of that would be the government declaring Article 155 of the Constitution to dissolve the Catalan Parliament.
Will this fuel the pro-independence drive among Catalans?
Oh, absolutely, certainly. Talking to friends of mine in Catalonia, some of whom have expressed that they're very disappointed with politicians on both sides of the debate in Catalonia. So I think there is an increased call for dialogue amongst the Catalan population.
Do you imply then that the outcome of last week's referendum might have been different had it been declared legal and gone ahead?
We would have had a very different outcome. It wouldn't have been 90% in favor of independence, that is for certain. It may have been just under or just over, and we would have had a lot more people would come out and vote because there would actually be an investment in doing so.
Stuart King downplays the risk of violence despite the refusal of Madrid to engage in negotiations. He said the images of police efforts violently trying to shut down last week's referendum resulted in sympathy for the voters and negative publicity for the Spanish government. Temperature records have tumbled across Australia as the nation's Weather Bureau reveals that September saw unprecedented heat across the country. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Parts of eastern Australia saw temperatures in September, the first month of spring in the southern hemisphere, climbed to 16 degrees Celsius above average, according to research by the Bureau of Meteorology. It studied two bursts of extreme heat that spread across large inland areas, from the southern state of Victoria to Queensland in the north. The survey found that seasonal factors and longer-term climate change were to blame, along with unusually dry conditions. Australia has had its warmest winter since records began in 1910, and one of its driest winters too. Some farming areas have had little or no rain for months. Craig Noyer, livestock agent in New South Wales state, says recent heat waves have demoralised the farming community.
The heat went straight through here and shocked a lot of animals and the country as well, and dried it out even more than as it was before. The last 6 months of no rain has had the greatest impact around here on the farmers. That's just another knife in the back kind of thing for the farmers. They need rain, not even hotter temperatures with winds.
Researchers have also found that Australia's two biggest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, could swelter through days of 50 degrees Celsius temperatures within a few decades. The study conducted by the Australian National University asks how the city's hospitals, schools and infrastructure would cope under such punishing conditions. Parts of Australia have endured temperatures close to 50 degrees Celsius, but they've mostly been small and remote country towns, not major population hubs. In her famous poem about Australia, the author Dorothea McKellar writes, "I love a sunburnt country, a land of droughts and flooding rains." While this is a nation well used to nature's extremes, many wonder how it will cope if, as expected, conditions get hotter and drier in the years to come. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Columbus Day is a national holiday in America, a day set aside to honor the Genoan who is credited with discovering the Americas through pluck and seamanship, and to celebrate the heritage of Italian Americans along the way. However, many Native Americans say that Columbus's heroic reputation contradicts the historical reality of the man whom they say brutalized and exploited indigenous peoples for gold and labor, and initiated centuries of conquest and genocide. They seek to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to people on both sides of the Christopher Columbus controversy.
Many Americans agree that Christopher Columbus was a genius as a seaman. With a flotilla of three tub-like ships paid for by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabel of Spain, he set sail in uncharted seas bound for the riches of the East. He landed in the Bahamas instead. Italian-American community leader Jude Anthony Ciscornia says his heroic qualities deserve to be honored with a national holiday.
That's part of what it is to be American, that ingenuity, thinking outside the box, being the first to do something, thinking forward, thinking ahead, doing something no one else is willing to do, doing something everyone else is too scared to do. That's what Columbus embodied. Why do people say he's a monster?
Because of what Columbus did after he arrived in the so-called New World, says Native American activist Dennis Robert Jennings.
He was a kidnapper. He was a murderer. He was a greedy warmonger. And he really exemplified sort of a personality of Europe for the historical time that said that all the rest of the world was theirs.
According to Columbus's own log, he and his sailors were met with hospitality and wonderment by the Arawak villagers who had lived on the islands for millennia. Columbus had been promised the governorship of any newfound lands, plus 10% of the profits. That was news to Native American rights activist John Curl, a Caucasian, who, like other Americans, had been taught in school that Columbus was a hero. As an adult, Curl read a magazine article about Columbus's edict requiring every Native American to pay him a monthly tribute in gold or have his hands cut off.
It just blew my mind. I knew nothing about this. And it turned out there really was not that much gold there. Because he didn't have enough gold, he started rounding up Indians and selling them back to Spain to be sold into slavery. So this is the man who invented the transatlantic slave trade.
But Jude Anthony Discornia says he doubts Columbus himself enslaved the native peoples.
I know he tried to convert them to Catholicism, which any Christian European person would have done at that time. It would have been almost illegal to go into what was considered a savage land and not try to Christianize these people. And it was only a matter of time. If Columbus didn't do it, there would have been some other European within 100 years in the 1500s that would have wound his way over there and did the same thing.
Dennis Robert Jennings does not speculate about what could have happened had Columbus not come, nor does he romanticize the native cultures Columbus encountered. But in helping to create Indigenous Peoples Day in 1992, he says he wanted Americans to know the full story. And he adds that the darker side of Columbus's legacy continues today with corporate exploitation of Native lands and environmental destruction.
We really did want to try to change people's consciousness about this whole perspective of greed and what is mine, mine, mine. We didn't want to think about it in terms of this is something that happened a long time ago. This continues to happen today in Guatemala, in Mexico, in El Salvador, Brazil, in places that there are tribal people. The people are worth nothing, and the resources of the land are worth everything.
So far, only a handful of U.S. municipalities have officially renamed Columbus Day Indigenous Peoples Day. Differing views of Columbus's legacy continue to polarize people, both in their communities and in the international arena. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thanks very much, Adam, and that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On October 12, 1492, three Spanish ships under the leadership of Christopher Columbus landed on an island in what is today the Bahamas. The anniversary of that event, observed annually in the United States as Columbus Day, initiated a vast global exchange of foods, animals, plants, peoples, and diseases that transformed the world, known today as the Columbian Exchange. For that reason, 1492 is considered by most historians to be the most significant year in modern world history. World population has increased more than four times since 1492, doubling between 1650 and 1850. Although a number of contributing factors are responsible for such enormous growth, clearly the most significant is an increased and improved food supply. The addition to the food supply of Native American food plants such as maize, potato, tomato, peanuts, manioc, pineapple, peppers, and cocoa beans was the most significant factor. The potato became the most important food source for the poor in Central and Northern Europe. Maize and manioc were introduced to Africa in the 16th century and replaced traditional African crops as the continent's most important staple food crops. The introduction to China of New World food crops, in particular potatoes, corn, and peanuts, resulted in a population boom between 1500 and 1650. By the 18th century, over one-third of the world's population lived in China. The Columbian Exchange was global, introducing new foods to every corner of the world. Before 1492, there were no oranges in Florida, no bananas in Ecuador, no paprika in Hungary. The exchange brought tomatoes to Italy, coffee to Colombia and Indonesia, pineapples to Hawaii, rubber trees to Africa, chili peppers to Thailand, China, and India, and chocolate to Switzerland. The landfall of the three small ships on an island in the Bahamas brought about unprecedented change in the course of history. It shaped the future of humankind for centuries to come, not just because of the discovery of a new continent, but because it brought about regular contact between the Earth's hemispheres, engendering trade, allowing for an exchange of ideas, and creating connections and encounters between cultures. In 1492, the peoples of the world began to come together as a global society, and that is good for all peoples.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.